Welcome to Women Worth Knowing, the radio program and podcast hosted by Cheryl Broderson and Robin Jones Gunn.
So you might remember previously that Mary Perro has been in studio with me when we've talked about some of the women worth knowing from history. Mm-hmm. And we also, Robin and I, had the privilege of doing two episodes with her.
Yes, it was.
Where Mary told us a little bit about herself, things that we didn't know before, but make us like her even more. And
yes.
I didn't think that was possible. But early when Jasmine and I first started Women Worth Knowing, one of the women we talked about was with Kathy Gilbert, mm-hmm. was Elizabeth Elliot. And it was great because Kathy knew her personally, but we talked more about the ministry and probably starting with the time after Jim was martyred. Mm-hmm. Mainly concentrating on that and then going on from there, what she did and what her life was like, her second, her third marriage. But one of the aspects that really was omitted was one that she talked about a lot when she was first a missionary. Yes. And went to Ecuador.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the ministry that she had there. And that's one of your favorite books. And
yes.
Then we found out that we actually both love that book. That was my first book that I read by her, and I loved it.
I love it so much. I have reread it and given it away as many times as I've reread it. So thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to share about Elizabeth Elliot's first year as a single missionary. For any of our listeners that might be less familiar, I'll just give you a real brief background that Elizabeth was born in Belgium in 1926 to missionary parents, but she moved back to the States when she was really young. But she remembers as a child, you know, there's always missionaries at the table. They were always meeting missionaries on boats coming in. They live close enough to New York. They were always sending missionaries off to faraway places. And she even had Betty Scott Stamm had stayed at her parents' house. And Betty Scott Stamm's father would write her letters and send her things. So she has these memories from childhood of missionaries being romantic and interesting people, but also that sharing the gospel was a really high calling. Of course, she would have known when Betty Scott Stamm was beheaded along with her husband. So she really did have an idea, somewhat, if not romanticized idea, of the mission life. She attended Wheaton in 1948, but it really wasn't until her junior year that she really personally felt a call, which to me was really interesting. I think when we read this book, the book we're referencing is These Strange Ashes. You get to see Elizabeth in kind of like a younger, more exuberant, maybe innocent and naive kind of way that we think of her often as this, you know, woman of God who knew what she was going to do forever, but she really didn't. You know, she didn't receive that call until she was a junior in college.
But you also see her brilliancy.
Yes.
She is so incredibly brilliant.
Yes.
And yet she takes that brilliancy and says, Lord, how can I use this for you?
How can I use it for you? Which is exactly what she did her junior year. And really started to see that she had this gift for language and switched her major to classical Greek and kind of went forward to be a Bible translator. And she was specifically interested in the idea of pioneer missions. Right. So translating the gospel into languages that no one, you know, they're still unwritten languages, mm-hmm. or they're unreached people groups. So, you know, after college, once again, she feels a call, but she doesn't know where she's going. I mean, she went to the Prairie Bible Institute. She goes to Alberta, Canada. She serves there for a while. She's just really looking like, Lord, where do you want? Where do you want me to go? And it's around that time that by the fall of like 1951, she's kind of starting to rule a few things out. Once again, she does not have this, I am to go to Ecuador kind of, that's not usually how it works. But she's ruled out Africa because, you know, she also got a letter, Robin, from Africa.
Oh.
Closed door. She didn't get a letter about being the laundry
Mary's
person.
Referring to when I applied to be a missionary in Africa and I was turned down. I thought, I am no good for the Lord.
Right. Well, sometimes that's how the Lord works. And it happened with Elizabeth, too.
Yes.
Closed doors, right? She also applied for the South Seas Evangelical Mission, and that was a closed door.
Really?
And yeah, and around that time, she realized that South America actually had less missionaries than Africa, which, you know, it kind of sounds like to her, maybe she thought there might be a greater need. Mm. And also, Jim Elliot was setting sail for Ecuador.
But she also didn't want to go to Ecuador
because
Jim was setting himself for Ecuador. She didn't want that to be part of
her
motivation.
She's very worried.
She's very worried.
That people might get the wrong idea.
That's right.
They had met at Wheaton and become friends and were in love. But they both really kind of wanted to serve the Lord and really make sure that this was his calling. So they hadn't really pursued a relationship. That's actually arguable, but technically hadn't pursued a relationship. But they get invited. So Elizabeth has kind of realized maybe that's where God's calling me. Maybe Ecuador, maybe South America. But, you know, she's a single woman in the early 1950s. Like, she can't just cruise on around the globe herself. So she's got to find another kind of companion single woman who might be willing. And she finds one in a woman named Dorothy. And they get invited by the Brethren Assembly that's living in New York. They have a little small church group. They're mostly Puerto Ricans in their congregation. They said, you can come serve and learn Spanish and raise funds. And she did. She shares of that, you know, time she was on a fifth floor walk up in Brooklyn. And like the hot water only came for a few hours each day.
Missionary prep
right there. Exactly. There were like big black rats big enough to knock over the garbage pail.
They still are there.
Yeah. She, you know, she says that, you know, it was good training for us living there. And we probably learned a little Spanish, too. Right. So around this time, she also meets Doreen Clifford, who is a British woman, another single woman, also already working in Ecuador with the Colorado people. And she kind of plants this seed. And so in 1952 is when Elizabeth and Dorothy set sail. Now, we've had a few conversations on women worth knowing about the dangerous journeys of these women.
Oh, yeah.
And just how, you know, difficult. But Elizabeth and Dorothy were on a passenger cargo ship with room for 52 passengers, AC, and a swimming pool. So they had like 10 days in the lap of luxury on the way to become missionaries.
This is your farewell to civilization and luxury.
And then they hopped on a 4-hour yacht to cruise down the Guayas River to head in inland. So the first 6 months that she's on her mission field, she's in Ecuador, in Quito. And Quito, the capital at the time, is kind of a way station for all these missionaries. We've read so many stories, you know, Nate and Marge Saint and other people who had come to Ecuador. They're learning Spanish in Quito because that's the national language. They're getting acclimated, maybe learning some medical. And then they're going to head out to these little stations. So she's doing that along with Dorothy, along with Pete, and along with Pete is Jim's colleague. So Jim is there. You know, there's a little more romance happening. and during that time, she makes the decision that she's going to go actually with Doreen and serve the Colorado tribe. So in order to get there, they've got to go over the Andes Mountains. Like, it's like 11,000 feet, maybe higher. They're deep in the, and then they're going to come down the other side. They do this on the back of a banana truck, cobblestone road, right? Mm. There's chains. They shut down part of the road so that, you know, the trucks can get through. It's a journey that takes an entire day. They climb all the way up. They move from the warmth of Quito to the freezing cold, the Andean winds, the rain. And what she says at this time was just talking about what an adventure is. The frontier lay before us. Obedience to God was the reason for the journey. And it was a good thing for me to remind myself of the reason, because on top of everything, it was really great fun. It was an adventure and held the thrill of adventure. And if I put my mind on the things before rather than the things that were behind, I had no sense whatever of gritting my teeth and doing a thing that I disliked. It was the thing I was made for, and I was full of gladness. Don't you love
it's
that?
It's delightful.
On the banana truck.
Yeah.
On the back of a banana truck.
Yes. She's bouncing on the cobblestone roads.
Yes.
But this is maybe one of the reasons why I love this book. I identify, and I think so many of our listeners will too, you know, whether you're becoming maybe a new mom or you're moving, you're starting a new job, maybe you're going overseas to missions, you like feel that sense of excitement, right? Like, what might the Lord do?
The best place in the world is the center of God's will.
That's exactly right. God has called me. What miracles might we see, right? So they arrive in Santo Domingo, which is the first stop on the way to this, you know, mission
outpost,
station,
right.
Outpost, thank you, where they're going to be going in San Miguel. And they arrive late at night, but she's got this excitement. She's like peering through the dark. You can imagine the jungle at night is now, it's warm and humid and the sound of the bugs. And but she sees a few lights and she can hear a few voices. And she thinks, you know, just what we were talking about, like, we are here. The Lord has sent us. What might he do? Well, she is in for I hate to say a rude awakening, but this is perhaps why I identify with this story so much. So she ends up in San Miguel the next day. They've got to get on a horseback to get there. The horses are more like ponies. And she says the mud is like up to the knees, you know, but the jungle on either side is gorgeous. And she, I mean, she really could have been a nature travel writer. Her writing about, you know, the jungle is just really, it's stunning writing. It was a beautiful forest with giant trees and ferns and elephant ears crowding each other in unimaginable luxuriance, draped with vines and flowering plants that gave forth unexpectedly sweet scents. Oh, doesn't that sound romantic?
Reminds me of Lila Strother.
Yeah.
She was a romantic missionary, too, to describe.
She does. Her descriptions are so good. And again, one of the things I love about the book is we get this picture of young Elizabeth, who is a little bit innocent and naive. She's but also excited, this youthful exuberance. So she gets there, and the first order of business for her is really to find an informant. She's a linguist. That's her job. She's living with three other single missionaries. And, you know, her descriptions of them, of course, two British women, and they're wearing cotton dresses because that was really what was appropriate on the clearing, even though Elizabeth came in boots. And San Miguel is just a small clearing with about six houses. The homes are bamboo with thatched roofs. So there's, you know, cracks and holes.
That's what I remember most of all with this book is just her talking about the bats flying overhead.
Yeah.
Eating the mosquitoes.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, they're trying to cook on a small, what they call a fogón, which is basically, she describes it as a sandbox with a fire in it. But of course, it's the jungle. It's wet and humid. They can't keep a fire going. So there's all these challenges that you hear her describe. It's really fun. But she's really, the thing she's praying for, the thing she's got her mind set on is, I need to find this informant. So she's going to be translating the not just translating, she, in order to translate the Bible into Colorado, she first has to learn Colorado and reduce the Colorado language into an alphabet, right? So the job is massive. She needs a person who's going to sit and talk with her, who knows the Colorado language. And she realizes when she gets to San Miguel, no Colorados live here.
Oops.
We've got a problem. So she finds out eventually they do come through, you know, once a week or so. And she's trying to talk to them, trying to meet them. No luck. She begins praying, Lord, this is your work, please. And sure enough, the Lord brings Don Macario, a middle-aged Ecuadorian who grew up on a hacienda with other Colorado children. He's completely bilingual. He speaks Spanish. He speaks the Colorado language. And he's a believer. Like, right? This is clearly their calling and what the Lord is doing. She begins meeting with him. They're having the best time. He had wanted to serve the Lord. She wants to serve the Lord. And she's working diligently to reduce this language. Now, again, like, I will remind you, she's trying to learn the language, but also, you know, what's that sound you're making? How do I create that into a symbol? So this is hard work. And she's meeting with him, you know, multiple times a week. She's paying him for the work. Things seem to be going pretty well until we get to what she calls her lessons of faith. And this is really how she organizes the book. I think it's what makes it so beautiful. Such a great story. And the first lesson in the school of faith is a Catholic priest and a nun move into this very small clearing to start their own school. And they begin spreading rumors that the evangelicos are devils, right? So there's friction. Mm-hmm. There's problems. There's division. And there's one family in particular that's causing a lot of problems, and that's the Quinones family. Now, you guys have talked quite a bit about some of these missionaries in these jungle stations or remote outposts. You know, a lot of the medical missionaries were required to do medical things as well. So Doreen, actually, one of the single women, had some medical training. Elizabeth has none, but they've taken, you know, a medical class in homeopathic medicine, what have you. So one evening, this Quinones family comes to them and says, we've got an emergency. You have to come. So they're called upon in the middle of the night. Doreen, the only medical person, is out of town for whatever reason. And Barbara and Elizabeth are called upon to go. Now, we know from the story that Doreen had previously warned this family during the last pregnancy, like, if you get pregnant again, you're going to need to go to keto. This is going to be complicated. We can't help you. But here, the time has come and she is pregnant again. She's ready to deliver the baby and it's an emergency. So they're walking into a terrible situation. You can imagine it's the middle of the night. They've got to ride the horses to get out there. And they walk in to total chaos. You can, like, Elizabeth's in her early 20s. She's young. And the family is going crazy. They're just wild with fear. They find Maruja, the woman who was pregnant, and they're looking, you know, has she delivered the baby yet? They're trying to discern what's happened. There's blood everywhere, people screaming. It's dark. Elizabeth looks around, like, certainly if there's this much blood, perhaps the baby has been born already, and sadly finds that the child had already passed away and has been just set aside in the corner. You can imagine how traumatic this is. Maruja is still alive, but she is in delirium at this point, in shock. She's lost too much blood. She's not going to live. There's really nothing they can do. And she, you know, walks into this and is like, Lord. They go home. Maruja dies. And that's, I mean, it, you can imagine coming home after the exhaustion and the emotion of a scene like that in the middle of the night. And, you know, Elizabeth says of that time, like, it was the first time I had seen someone die. And the despair that the death brought to the three men who had surely never learned to put their hope in God. But there was another reason for my sleeplessness that night. We had been defeated. An opportunity had been given to us to reach the most resistant family in San Miguel. It was a life and death matter. And if God had spared Maruja's life, the whole tribe might have been delivered from spiritual death. In my heart, I could not escape that thought that it was God who failed. Surely he knew how much was at stake. Surely he could have done better by us. To my inner cries and questionings, no answer came. Oof, right?
Don't you love the fact that she's wrestling with these issues? And I think that's one of the things I appreciated is that she wrestles through these. Mm-hmm. She doesn't just have easy platitudes or easy answers.
Right.
She wrestles.
Yeah.
And relate. These are the things that I think every believer who goes any deeper than just a surface is going to wrestle with these things, these issues.
Dark night of the soul.
Exactly.
Yes.
Well, she's going to have about four.
She's going to have a few more.
Yes.
And she speaks so honestly and directly.
Yes.
I've come back to this book so many times in times when I've been facing loss or difficulty or tragedy. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, Lord, I don't understand. It's beautiful. So she's, you know, having her dark night of the soul. And of course, you know, after life is slow, right? Letters travel in and out the same way that she traveled in and out over this giant mountain on the backs of banana trucks. She has a lot of time to think and to kind of wrestle, as you said.
And she doesn't really have a close relationship with her roommates, where she can talk with these issues over.
Yeah.
And so that's part of it, too. Again, the loneliness, too, of even though I've got these coworkers, there's not the kinship that you would want. So you could say, can we talk about this? Mm-hmm. So there's not that either.
Yeah, I think that's something she kind of struggled with throughout her life was really closeness with other women or other missionaries.
Saints,
absolutely. So it's January of 1953 now, and in the morning she's reading her daily devotion and she reads 1 Peter, and it says, think it not strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you as though some strange thing happened to you, but rejoice inasmuch as you are partakers in Christ's sufferings. No sooner does she read that last word than she hears gunshots out in the clearing, and then Don Macario is dead. Someone shot Don Macario. They've killed him. She runs out to find her colleague, her friend, her beloved Christian brother, the man that God sent to help her do her mission work, lying dead. And, you know, there's nothing can be done. He's been shot in the head. So they're waiting a few hours. The authorities come out. The authorities tell them rule of law for this situation is we have to do an autopsy. Well, no doctors present. Who's going to do the autopsy? Doreen and Elizabeth. They quickly realize they're not going to be able to probe this man's skull and pull out a bullet. They've got to saw his head open.
Oh,
I know it. So
stop.
I apologize. I'm not going to go any further. But imagine if you've not been trained to do that kind of work, how gruesome it would be for any person if you did not know.
Especially a friend.
But a friend
makes it a colleague
level. Someone you've been working
worse,
with.
Yes.
And she's so young, and she saw her first death the day before.
Yeah, or just a short while before. I don't know how it's very close.
Wow.
So she finds out there, you know, there'd been a fight the night before, a dispute over who owned the land, and they shot him dead. So they finally get the bullet out, and now the authorities are going to go outside and catch the murderers. Well, the murderers are long gone. This is hours later. They look around. We don't see any murderers. Saddle their horses and ride off. So no justice is done.
Wow.
After the funeral, Elizabeth wrote to her parents, "It was the most nightmarish day of my life. Although I could by no stretch of the imagination hold myself responsible for Macario's murder, the enormity of it weighed down on me almost as heavily as if I was guilty. It was another failure, somehow, a judgment on us and our work. I went over it in my mind, how it had come to be that I was here at all, that Macario had been my colleague. The work we did together was the work to which each had clearly been called. We had been called, had we not?"
Mm.
Oh, so you can imagine now we've got, yes, we're going to have to break here in a little bit and give her second two lessons in a future episode. But I want to share with you what Elizabeth talks about in, you know, retrospect later looking back. She says, "Faith's most severe tests come not when we see nothing, but when we see a stunning array of evidence that seems to prove our faith is in vain. If God were God, if he were omnipotent, and if he cared, would this have happened?" Ugh. I mean, we're just back to that wrestling again.
Yeah.
Well, it goes back to that age-old question. You know, if God is good, then he's not powerful. If he's powerful, then he's not good.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're always wrestling with that. Yes, he is good and he is powerful. So why isn't he intervening?
Right.
And we have to understand that our world is covered in sin.
Yes.
And you have to, if you don't factor in the sin and the fall, nothing makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But I love the book, too, because she calls it These Strange Ashes.
Yes.
In other words, it turns around. Ashes, mm-hmm. because he gives beauty for ashes.
Yes.
And so how we have these ashes in our lives that God accepts. And I just love that. So, you know, for those who are listening, those burned out places, those places like we talked about that are so disappointing that you think are going to go one way. And then it goes another way. You think this is the ticket in. This is, I mean, I've had so many times where I thought, oh, this is going to be the thing that ends this trial. And it only, like, sometimes adds to the severity of the trial. So that's not the means that God wants to use.
Yes.
And so that's what she's learning through this. And as you said, we'll come back for another episode. But you said that this spoke to you as a young missionary, your first time reading it. And what were some of the, because I think that's, I think a book speaks to us when we say, This I relate to this. I know this feeling.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things she said, she finished the alphabet shortly after this without Don Macario, even though the work was slow. One of the things she said was, "Instead of feeling triumphant, I was aware that the job had taken me longer than necessary. And I felt guilty for allowing so many things to distract me. My labor turned to dust." But that same day, she picks up her devotional. And ironically, it says the verse, "I have fought the good fight. I have finished the course and I have kept the faith." And I think one of the things this book has spoken to me over and over about places that I look at and I think that's dead. That's gone. And it's not. You know, Romans 4:17 says that he is the God who calls dead things to life. He is the same God that speaks to things that aren't there as if they were there. And it's just been such an incredible reminder and testimony to me that sometimes when I'm looking at a chapter of my life that looks like ashes, that looks like it meant nothing, that God actually sees it completely differently, and I can trust I can trust him with that.
Such a good word. I'm so glad you said that. We all have experienced that.
Yes,
oh, definitely.
We need the stories to remind us of how God works in a life. Mm-hmm. It's not unusual for all the wheels to fall off just when you thought you were going down the hill. Everything's great.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things it says in 1 Peter 5, 2 and 3 is it says, you know, be aware that the enemy prowls about like a lion, seeking whom he'd devour. Resist him steadfastly in the faith, knowing that your brothers and sisters are experiencing the same thing.
Exactly.
And I think it's those times when you realize, I'm not alone. This is par for the course. I'm not off course. I'm on course.
Yes.
And this is what I can expect. You know, Tim Keller was so good because he used to say, before you're saved, you've got one enemy. And it's you're the problem because you're resisting God. He said, but after you get saved, you've got a whole, you know, demonic host that is trying to thwart you. So that is part one of Young Elizabeth Elliot. We will be back next week for part two.
Can't wait.
It's so good. It's so worthwhile.
Thank you, Mary. Thanks for bringing that to us.
Thank you for listening to Women Worth Knowing with Cheryl Broderson and Robin Jones Gunn. For more information on Cheryl, visit CherylBroderson.com or follow her on Instagram or Facebook. For more information on Robin, visit RobinGunn.com or follow her on Instagram or Facebook. Join us each week for a lively conversation as we explore the lives of well-known and not-so-well-known historical and contemporary Christian women. We hope you've enjoyed today's episode. Make sure you rate us on your podcast app, subscribe, and share it with a friend. Thank you again for listening to Women Worth Knowing with Cheryl Broderson and Robin Jones Gunn.